read somewhere that the Sufi poet Hafiz was once asked a question. What is the sign of someone who truly knows God? And it said that he responded to the question like this. He looked at the young woman and paused for quite a while before he said anything. When he spoke, he said, they've learned to drop the knife. They've learned to drop the cruel knife most so often used upon their tender self and that of others. The knife that we're most often using upon our tender self and others is judgment. And this knife of judgment is the instrument of separation. And it's a very favorite tool of our ego. A Course in Miracles says that it's not that we shouldn't judge, it's that we can't. That to judge anything accurately would be to be aware of an inconceivably wide range of factors. For example, the reasons why someone acted the way they did, said what they did, the background to that, the history to that, the influences in the environment for that happening, the effects of that happening on everything, on everyone, on the whole. And that to judge someone accurately would also to be aware of the consequences or the effects of our judgment, our assessment, not only on the person and the situation at the time, but in the future, in the time to come. And then it goes on to say, who except in arrogant fantasies could claim to have such information at all times? I thought that was extraordinary when I first came upon it, and so true. And how so often our judgments that cause grievances and painful stories between us and within us are really based on not having the full information, not really understanding the wide range of factors that go into things being the way they are. And so this is really why we need forgiveness, why every spiritual path emphasizes the importance of the virtue of forgiveness. Some have teachings that open up the how more than others. But again, A Course in Miracles says that God doesn't forgive because God's never condemned. Which is, of course, the non-dual reality. There's no condemnation or judgment in the depth of reality. And so it reveals that, you know, the forgiveness is really something that we need for ourselves. We need to forgive ourselves and to forgive one another. And that this really cuts to the heart of what it is to really live our spiritual practice and path in real life with one another in the midst of our humanity. And we all know that it's really easy to be mindful, peaceful, compassionate, when no one's ruffling our feathers and we're not being disturbed. So we can control our situation. Only, you know, the minute we start interacting with others, all that flies out the window. And so spiritual practice is not just for the times that we're here in a situation like this in Sangha. It's every moment, every breath, every interaction, the whole of our life. So I thought today would be a good opportunity for us to take a closer look at self-forgiveness in particular. And I got the sense to teach on this today based on some emails and comments I had from some of you last time after the work we did in the chair. where I mentioned something that was first termed by the scholar Kenneth Watney, who recently died, who called this very foundational dynamic of ego structure the unholy trinity of sin, guilt, and punishment. So I wanted to unpack that more specifically, seeing that seemed to mean something for many of you last time I mentioned it. So this sin thing is not remotely exclusive to the Christian religion. They just picked up on it and named it. But if you look at all of the biblical stories common to all the great Western religions, you see so frequently how early human beings, these characters in the Bible that really represent aspects of our own consciousness. That's really another way to read those stories, is to read them as map stories about our own mind. So often they're interpreting situations, reality, and making them mean, I must have done something wrong. We are being punished for the floods, for the bad weather. You see this in shamanic traditions. You see this in the East with the way people work with the notion of karma. Right? And so we see that this unholy trinity is a very foundational cornerstone of ego consciousness itself. Starting from how we interpret the fact of our experience of separation. So we see it in that biblical story of Adam and Eve, which we could look at not as either a fictional creation story, or we could look upon it as, the story of the formation of ego mind, human mind. If we were to look at it like that, we see Adam and Eve, meaning you and I, ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's duality. Good, evil, right, wrong, acceptable, not acceptable, duality, split. To eat of something means to take it in, digest it. What we digest and metabolize becomes us. So we ate of this dual tree. And notice what happened the minute that occurred. All of a sudden, Adam and Eve experienced what?
Guilt.
Guilt and shame, precisely. A sense of, we're naked, we've done something wrong, we need to hide. Any sense of, I have to hide something, reveals shame present. So what in our commonly worldly thinking has to happen if we're guilty? We've got to get punished, right? We've got to pay off the guilt somehow. Through what? Some form of penance or suffering. See, this is how our ego believes errors are corrected. We see it expressed very clearly in our criminal justice system, which the whole Western world agrees and believes in. Somebody is judged guilty, and the consequence for that predicament, that verdict, is some form of punishment, whether it comes through love being withheld to that person, freedom being withheld or restrained from that person, some form of suffering imposed on that person. So often I hear it said that, someone's sick, oh, that's my karma, as if somehow the sickness is a paying off of something we did, I don't know when. Right? But what actually happens? So let's follow this through a little bit. So we pay off, we do the penance, we do the suffering, but does that let us off the hook? No, it doesn't seem to, does it? It reifies the foundational error that we are eating of, which is, aren't fundamentally flawed or bad or sinful or wrong or evil or defective because I find myself separate. And around we go again. And again and again. And it can be subtle. This is what can cause us to take on judgments of others and really have it affect us deeply in a way that is pernicious. Where we can't stand up for ourselves and say, look, I'm sorry you feel that way, I'm interested to learn what it is that's gone on between us, it's been really difficult. But where we're taken out by the judgment and the condemnation of another, why? Because somewhere in there we agree that this is right. Sometimes we punish ourselves. We withhold kindness and appropriate love and compassion towards our own humanity. We tend to hate ourselves for our weaknesses, for the places where we don't feel strong. And this is really, really important, because if we grab on to our weaknesses, the places where we're not yet fully enlightened, and we all have them, places where we react fearfully, defensively, aggressively, where we haven't yet learned to be more present, more awake in certain situations, we can very easily use that as evidence for see how flawed you are, see how imperfect you are. And that strengthens and feeds this notion of fundamental guilt and badness. I was listening to Adi Ashanti a while back, and I heard him speak about a translation that's not commonly understood about the Buddhist Heart Sutra, Gate Gate Karangate Karasamgate Vrindasvaha. And of course, most of us would know that the translation is gone far beyond, gone all the way, far beyond, full enlightenment. The wisdom is, Buddha is. But it goes on to say, always Buddha, becoming Buddha. And Adi Ashanti was talking about that Gate Gate includes both being and becoming. And this is very important as we explore what's always part of the spiritual path, which is the paradox. The paradox of the fact that we are what we are. Our true nature is that. Always, always is that. Is always God. The foundation of ourself is the holiest of holies, and it can't be other, and it can't be tainted. That the truth in you and I and everything and everyone remains as radiant as a star, as pure as light, as innocent as love itself. And we're all still works in progress. For as long as we're breathing, there are things to see and learn. The purity of what we are can unfold and land and deepen more and more. And that's certainly my experience. And so it's vitally important in our practice that we hold both aspects, that we understand that the deep non-dual includes both dual and non-dual, actually. It really does. It includes the pure being and the fact that we're becoming. The fact that we're also becoming means stuff's going to come out of our unconscious that we didn't know was there. It's likely going to be relationships that pushes on it and brings it forward. That's part of what relationships are for. That's why the ark, Noah's ark, was entered two by two. It just came to me this morning as I was showering. How the significance of that. That it's really in relationship that we get to see more, that we get the mirroring to see more about ourselves and how profound that really is. And when we understand that the power of relationship to help us see more, we see that part of the function of relating and living ordinariness in our being together, whether we're consciously practicing in the way we are here in the Sangha, or whether we're just interacting in the world with people we work with and people we deal with in ordinary life, and we get our buttons pressed and react this way and that. There's something that wants to wake up further in amidst all of that, that's part of the becoming, the waking up fully, including every aspect of our humanity in the process. And forgiveness really helps us in this. So forgiveness, in a way, isn't necessary when we're really deeply at rest in what we actually are fundamentally. It's kind of like a non-concept. It's not needed. Because forgiveness is a bridge that helps us relax the position, relax the fixation that our judgments are accurate ones, helps us relax our faithfulness in this notion of sin and guilt, in our obedience to punishment as the mechanism by which errors are corrected. So forgiveness isn't really something we do, because it doesn't come from our ordinary mind. It's like a presence that arises from grace, like a healing breeze, that dissolves the positions and the judgments and the assumptions and the defenses. And it helps us really be with everything, with our humanity and that of another, with the places where we're not yet fully awake, in a way that's very spacious and truly loving and compassionate. And it brings forth deeper understanding and wisdom. It actually returns us to that non-dual abiding of our fundamental purity. Not just yours, but everyone's. That indestructible part of us that just is what it is, and it's so beautiful. But forgiveness is usually challenging, so we haven't had a lot of good instruction or training in it. So often we don't know how to forgive, and usually the person for whom it's hardest for us to forgive is ourselves. Our mind is very addicted, takes hold of the lacks and the limitations and the shortcomings, and uses them as evidence against us. how do we work with this? How do we drop the knife? Whether we're wielding the knife towards ourselves or towards another, because ultimately it's the same. How do we let the windows and doors open wide and some fresh breeze of grace blow through our whole systems that then allows us to honestly practice? This is what forgiveness gives us. It gives us the capacity to actually really embody love of the truth in a more genuine way. When we're outside of this cycle of sin and guilt and punishment, we're not afraid to look honestly at whatever's going on. And we can look with a forgiving, compassionate gaze, just interested to see, where am I? What am I? What's here? What's coming forward to be seen and understood and known and all things need and want to come home. So I'm bringing this forward today because without looking at it, we will be bumped back up to the surface of our personality again and again. Without dealing with this, we are very likely to hit glass ceilings in our inner practice, whether our primary practice is meditation, inquiry, prayer, or anything else. We will find this resistance manifesting in a lot of different ways, sometimes by just avoiding engaging our practice as deeply as we could. Sometimes by just getting caught up in emotional dramas that swallow up a lot of our time and energy. Sometimes by just being very distracted. All of that can be resistance. Fear of going deeper. Why? If we don't face and question and investigate, what is it that makes me sinful? What have I really done? What am I holding against myself? That we've made mistakes is obvious. That we are likely to make more mistakes is also obvious. So we want to be able to see those mistakes so they can surely be corrected, not by punishment, but by the pure light of awareness and deeper understanding that always wants to liberate us, not deepen the knots and the fearful fantasies that not only our minds, but most of the structures of the world actually run off. So, I'm throwing down the gauntlet for today. Let's see where this resonates and relates to where you are. To the questions and the grapplings and the challenges that you find yourself with. Remembering that where you are, where you find yourself, what's arising, both your sincere questions and the grapplings are the gateway itself. So, what is it? Come.